Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In the end of our show, I'll be chatting with Taylor Hyatt from Not Dead Yet. So tell me a little bit about Not Dead Yet.
Well, Choose Your Bone, Not Dead Yet is the Canadian affiliate of disability rights organization Not Dead Yet in the U.S. We were founded in 2013, and our goals are to inform, unify, and give a platform to disabled people and our allies and co-workers who oppose assisted suicide as a form of disability discrimination, as well as euthanasia and other ending-of-life procedures.
So when it comes to the issues of assisted suicide and euthanasia, do you find that for a person with a disability, sometimes the cause might be financial, like they don't want to be a drain on someone?
That's an interesting way to frame it, because in my work, we compare the Canadian and American healthcare systems a lot. And unfortunately, there's a bit of a stereotype where you Canadians are so much better off. Everything you need is covered by the government, while we're struggling down south here. That's definitely not the case. Cam, have you heard the name Sean Taggart before?
I'm afraid I have not.
Okay, so he was a father living in BC. He acquired a disability later in life and was raising a young son. His condition had gotten to the point where he needed 24-hour care in his home, and government authorities would only allow him 20 of those 24 hours a day. And they said, if you want to make up the other four, you're going to have to live in a nursing home, in an institution. And a lot of disabled people resist this idea because you are isolated, you are, you're on the schedule of the staff, and you receive subpar care. Your needs are almost put into competition with others, and everything is done on a schedule. So he fought the provincial government for a couple of years, hoping to get an increase in care. And unfortunately, last week he was worn out and wasn't getting anywhere, and finally opted to end his life with the quote-unquote help of our medical system. You can't, and it's our view that you can't have a choice in how to die if you don't have a choice in where and how you live. The the media headlines on Mr. Taggart's story are saying, British Columbian father chooses assisted death after fighting the government for care, but was it really a choice? We don't think so at all.
So, what message would you send to the community to speak out against this sort of thing?
I would say to dig deeper than the story that pop culture and the media are telling us right now. Absolutely, people are suffering, and suffering needs to be addressed, but you need to ask the question, what kind of suffering is going on, and what is available to lighten that load? If it's a mental health issue, what services can I access? If it's a mobility issue, what devices can I access to make life easier and make myself more independent? Instead, death is being sold as a cure-all, a be-all, end-all.
So, in your work, has there been any success story where you've been able to advocate against euthanasia or assisted suicide?
Again, that's an interesting question, because a lot of the really important work is almost above the level of advocates. Decisions about how the procedures are going to work are made in government and in academia, places where the average person has a hard time making themselves heard, and especially people with disabilities can't always travel or have the resources to spend making their stories public. Success story, if you can call it that, are you familiar with Roger Foley from the London, Ontario area?
Vaguely, yes.
Yes. Okay, so this gentleman, he was in his 40s, and his condition had progressed to the point where he was relying on government-provided home care staff to come into his home and assist him with his daily needs. And the staff were neglectful. They caused fires in his apartment, dropped him during wheelchair transfers, and all kinds of horrifying things. This caused him to be isolated and eventually suicidal, and he landed in the hospital. And because he refused to go back to that subpar care, he was eventually given the choice of pay for your care in the hospital as if you didn't have health insurance, or go back to the subpar care that you had received, or here, have a lethal injection. Eventually, when the UN Special Rapporteur came to visit Canada earlier this year, he was able to be in touch with her and is now receiving the home care that he waited so long for.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Gladly.
Coming up next, we're going to hear a little bit from Ken Pope about the latest cases involving Henson Trusts and RDSPs. So tell me about some of the recent cases involving Henson Trusts or RDSPs.
Well, the most recent Henson case is a Supreme Court of Canada case based on a BC file. And what it did was it established at the Supreme Court level that Henson Trusts and the assets held by Henson Trusts and the funds dispersed by Henson Trusts don't affect any kind of social benefits. In this kind of situation, it was a geared-to-income housing situation where the housing wanted disclosure of the trust asset and income and so on. And the case was clearly settled that these factors aren't pertinent, because of course there's an annual statement of assets and income, and but it's clear now that the trust is separate from all that, which we knew anyway, but now the Supreme Court confirms it. And in this particular case, it was interesting because the beneficiary is a joint trustee with another family member. So what we now know as well is that a person can be a joint trustee. They couldn't be joint and several. They couldn't be able to act on their own, even though there's two of them. And they certainly couldn't be the sole trustee, in my opinion, but there can be two jointly. So that's interesting to have that affirmed at the Supreme Court level.
So this would be a victory for anyone else going on with a housing dispute in terms
of... Absolutely. I mean, what happens is you have many, let's say, well-intentioned but misinformed people working for supported living and especially geared to income housing situations. And I have to say that in some situations, it's a small amount of jealousy involved as well, because someone who's getting geared to income housing, it's found out that there's a trust for them in some unknown amount, but of course people tend to inflate whatever their expectations are, and of course they don't have a trust fund left by their dad who died after you cared for them for 10 years. And so there's a certain sense of jealousy in some cases. But, that cynical perspective being said, it's very nice to know that Henson Trusts are completely exempt from all of these factors. And as a courtesy, you might be prepared to give some certain information. But the fact that you may be requested by first-time low-level administrators to disclose this information doesn't mean you have to.
So when it comes to the trust itself, wouldn't some of that money be going to things like medical expenses or disability appliances anyway? So
it would. Much of it would be spent, if needed, on disability-related expenses. And then beyond that, what happens is, of course, is the parents have helped keep the child in some modest lifestyle while they were alive. I can't think of one where it's a flamboyant situation where they, have unlimited funds and live better than the rest of the world. It's always a modest situation. And the disbursements from the trust are usually very realistic and very reasonable.
So that makes the jealousy factor pretty illogical right there.
That's exactly a fact. It's no doubt about that.
So what sort of steps can a person take to ensure their right to disclose or not to disclose is actually protected? Because some people might fall into that trap of hearing, you have to tell us this, or we need to know that.
Well, you're right. That's a very difficult situation, because what happens is somebody says, well, you have to tell us certain information, and if not, we'll suspend your benefits or we'll charge you market rent, or, it's very threatening. Just how you get the word out to everybody so that they know that they can rely upon this, I'm not sure. I suppose this would all be good information to make sure that at the very least that, that legal aid clinics have, and that private bar lawyers that do, landlord-tenant, for example, for people on provincial benefits, would be a good thing for them to know. Just how you convey all that to them, I don't know. I'll tell you the truth.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you could stay for a sec, that'd be great. Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
From Friday, September 6th to Sunday, September 8th, the Dominion House Tavern presents the CGM Opt-In Festival 2019. Three nights of music featuring over 20 artists, all playing in support of CGM FM. On Friday, get Loud with Gypsy Chief Goliath, Case the Joint by Kingdom Slum, Butchers, and This Is War. Saturday has Rock Vibes with Dogtone, Years of Earnest, American Airport Sushi, Border Patrol, Help, and Dave Russell and the Precious Stones, while Sunday features South River Slim and a Windsor singer-songwriter circle with Ron Leary, Tara Watts, Max Marshall, and many more. Tickets for Friday and Saturday are $15 each, with $5 going directly to CJAM FM. Sunday is pay what you can, and a portion of Dominion House sales go to CJAM for the entire weekend. Help support CJAM 99.1 FM and check out the Opt-In Festival from Friday, September 6th to 8th at the Dominion House, 3140 Sandwich Street in Windsor. This event is sponsored by Walkerville Brewery.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Ken Pope and Taylor Hyatt. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Jack Johnson, will be telling us a little bit about Fabry disease. So tell me a little bit about Fabry and the work that's going on in regards to it.
Fabry is a rare lysosomal storage disorder. The traditional view of Fabry is that it affects a small percentage of individuals, about 3 in every 100,000, one male and two females. And the work that's being done is there's a lot of research that is going on. There's great interest in trying to treat Fabry. There are a couple treatments already available, but they're working on new ones, and there's gene therapy work that's going on. There's work improving the existing form, main form of treatment with enzyme replacement therapy. And then there's a pill treatment that has been approved and doesn't work for everybody, but for those it does, it seems to do well. And then there's another pill that's in trials right now that they're working on. So there's a lot of activity.
So how does the condition typically affect a person?
Normally, the young men in particular will start having problems in their school years, oftentimes before 10 years old, and that'll manifest with burning pain in the hands and feet. There may be a lack or inability to sweat, so dealing with warm temperatures can be a problem. With the girls, it usually starts a little bit later and is a little more mild, but women can suffer from Fabry just as severely as the men do.
So, in your time working with the organization, what sorts of challenges have presented themselves in regards to this work?
Well, there's education and knowledge is really one of the biggest challenges. Since Fabry disease is so rare, it's not very well known in the medical community. Also, Fabry can have lots of different symptoms, and not everybody's the same. So it can look like more common conditions. So patients may be misdiagnosed or treated for the wrong things at times. Sometimes doctors just can't figure it out, and they think that a person may be faking some of the symptoms. So getting a correct diagnosis is definitely one of the big challenges that many with Fabry face.
Well, to look at the converse side of things, in your time with the organization, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
I've been working with the organization. We started in 1996, and at that time, women were viewed as just carriers of the disease and that it didn't really affect them. But we quickly saw after starting the organization that that was not the case, that women, many women were suffering very severe symptoms, which was not the traditional view at all of Fabry. So we worked to educate on that point in particular, and then when clinical trials started and the doctors that were involved started gathering more information, and they began to recognize as well that women did suffer from the disease much more so than they were ever given credit for previously. So that was a real victory for the female patient population. Also, we do have treatments available now. So working with the medical community, with the patient community, getting patients into clinical trials, helping with those efforts, getting those trials completed so that the regulators were able to recognize and approve the medication for treatment was a huge success. So those are just a couple of the things that we've been able to do that were, you know, very important early on.
So if you could send any message to the community about why this work matters and why we should keep pushing forward to make sure those affected have the best treatments, what would you say?
Well, the real importance is to get new products approved, to continue to participate in clinical trials, because the treatments that we have now, while we're very glad to have them, they're not as effective as we had originally hoped. So we want to see the next generation of treatments make it to market so that patients can benefit from those.
So what are the next immediate steps?
Well, as I said, you know, participating in the clinical trials, if they're appropriate for anyone, and to continue with education and so forth. So many times patients, individuals need to be proactive for their own health. That's very important, especially with rare diseases. Since the medical community often doesn't know anything about them, it's important for affected individuals and family members to be as knowledgeable as they can be about the condition so that they can pass that information on to the doctors and others in the medical community to help spread awareness.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
At the start of today's show, folks, I did a thing on Not Dead Yet and how assisted suicide and euthanasia can really affect the lives, not just of a person with a disability, but their families, their friends, anyone who cares that a human life matters would be affected. I'm of the opinion, personally, that it's never all right to simply end a life. We don't have a cure today, true, but we might have one tomorrow, or at least a step in that direction. As long as we keep hope alive. When it comes to things like rare conditions, whether they're affecting one person or a billion, makes no difference. We owe them our best as a people, just to make sure that there's some chance of a better life. If we allow ourselves to take on the mindset that there's no hope, there is no tomorrow, that becomes our reality. Because we're living with a precept that's ultimately self-defeating. We're saying to this segment of the population, it's not big, it doesn't draw in a lot of money, we're not going to be there to help you, simply because it's an unknown, it's not a household name. Supposing it is. Supposing someone out there wandering around has this condition, and they just don't know it. And at what point can we place the value of one life over another? At what point can we say, because this person has financial or political influence, and they bring in a lot of money, we're going to support this rare condition,
we never heard of that, and it's only affecting three people, and they're a continent away. So what does it matter to us? It matters because we are all human life. We are all part of this great tapestry, this great community. And you cannot underestimate the potential of anyone. You can't say that because you have this rare condition, and I personally don't think you're going to amount to anything, that you aren't. Who knows? This person might find the strength or the wherewithal to grow up, invent something great, change the world, make it just a better place. But it all comes down to the support a person receives today. No matter how old or how young a person is, no matter how much money they have, no matter how they've lived their lives, life is a beautiful gift. And given that, it's also an entirely irreplaceable gift. You can never, ever have one person take the place of another. So, to discard, or to worse still, end the life of anyone simply because their condition might be a stumbling block that we don't know how to deal with is not something we can do as a people. We have to expect better of ourselves. When it comes to things like Fabry, it might be a condition. Not a lot of people know what it is, and it might not be evident from the day the child is born. Doesn't matter whether it's a disability someone's born with, one that they acquire somewhere along the way. It has to be that the medical community takes it upon themselves not just to say, I got the degree, ain't I great? It's lifelong learning. The medical community should take it upon themselves to look at some of the conditions that aren't household names, just so they know how to deal with things correctly. It's nothing worse than having to explain what's bothering you to a doctor who just doesn't believe it. And the fact is, if you're in pain, you're in pain. If it's affecting you, it's affecting you. You're not going in there to waste your time and his by fabricating symptoms. The truth of the matter is, we can all benefit by an expanded understanding. We can all take a look at some of the cases out there and just understand for ourselves not just what these conditions are, what they mean, but that life is worth living no matter what. If you press on, if you have hope for just another day, you might find something awaiting you tomorrow that makes the struggle worth it. If you're someone with a story of disability life, write HandyLink 4, HandyLink, numeral 4, gmail.com. Always do love to hear your stories, whether it be someone inventing an accessible synthesizer or just someone who wants better transit laws in their city. The door's always open. I mean, everyone with a disability or without has a story to share, and a connection to disability life. Maybe not an obvious connection, but furthering to my point, any life, whether they have a disability or not, is worth living. And we all have someone who cares about us, someone we need to survive and to press on for. And if we think of that someone in our most difficult moments, we always find a way through. And maybe it's not the easiest thing in the world. Maybe it's gonna hurt to get your legs up and pumping again. But the truth is, surviving the pain allows us to see the pleasure that is worth living for, the people who brighten our existence, and what we bring to theirs, how we change lives simply by being at our best. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.